Our final speaker today is Dr. Craig Ramey. He's a university professor of psychology, pediatrics, and neurobiology, and he's director of the Civitan International Research Center at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Now, the Civitan Center is a research center dedicated to understanding human development and to treating and preventing learning and social disabilities. During the past 30 years, he's conducted studies of over 14,000 children and families in over 40 states, and this research has been supported by grants, more than 100 grants from federal and state agencies and private foundations. Dr. Ramey is the author of over 220 publications, including 5 books. His latest 2 books were co-authored with his wife, Dr. Sharon Ramey, Right from Birth, Building Your Child's Foundation for Life, First 18 Months, and Going to School, How to Help Your Child Succeed. These books are going to be sold by the university bookstore at a free public lecture that he's giving on campus this afternoon at 4 o'clock in 228 Educational Sciences. So anyone is welcome to attend that, or if you want to mention it to your colleagues, they're welcome to attend. 228 Educational Sciences at 4. He's also given over 500 professional presentations, many to policy audiences. He's addressed 9 legislatures, the National Governors Association, the National Conference of State Legislators, the National Association of Attorneys General, the Council of Chief State School Officers, and his research focuses on factors that affect successful transitions to school, but also really the creation of a whole new generation of early childhood education, health, and family support programs. He's won many awards, including the American Psychological Association's Award for Exemplary Prevention Research, and some consider his Abecedarium program one of the best, if not the best, childhood education program in the country. Now, when I hear an introduction of a person with such an impressive record, you know, I can't help but wonder, how much practical experience does he really have? And Dr. Ramey tells me he and his wife have children aged 33, 31, and 30, and I guess he loves this early childhood education stuff so much that he and his wife Sharon had a 4th child who's 7. So he's getting hands-on experience probably every day. So, we're so pleased, Dr. Ramey, that you're taking time to join us. And the title of his talk is Helping Children Get Started Right, The Benefits of Early Childhood Intervention.
Thank you, Karen. I am absolutely delighted to be here. You know, Wisconsin is a real beacon in the country for so many progressive ideas. And so it is with some trepidation that I come from Alabama to Wisconsin to talk about social policy. I do have some information I think you might find helpful if you don't already know it. And I'm going to not do the usual theoretical background and placing it into context. I'm going to really use a literature style beginning in medias res. I'm going to start in the beginning of the story, in part because you are such a progressive state that you know that there are many factors that lead to children being in poverty, and you know that poverty takes a toll on children and families in many different ways. And you certainly know that poverty is strongly associated with children not being ready to do what school will ask them to do when they arrive in kindergarten, and that on average, children from poverty don't do as well during school, and they drop out earlier than do children from more affluent families. So with that said, I want to move directly into an experiment that we have been conducting. This is the 30th year that this experiment and its associated experiments have been running. We really ask a very simple question, beginning in 1970 with pilot work. We wanted to know whether it was possible not just to remediate problems that children have that make them not ready for school, because even back in 1970, the evidence was that we weren't doing a great job at catching kids who were woefully behind and helping them get into the mainstream of public school. So we asked a different question. Could we prevent those difficulties that are cognitively and socially based in children from occurring if we did everything that we then thought was important to do to support their early childhood education and to support their families? And that has become known as the Abecedarium Project. And let me turn on the projector in the hope that the slides that I have will allow that old saw about a picture is worth a thousand words. I'm going to give you an essay in 22 minutes that is the equivalent of two-thirds of a minute per year in this project, and describe the work of over 50 PhDs, MDs who have worked with me on this project. The Abecedarian project, and by the way, Abecedarian comes from Latin, and it comes to English via Middle French, and it means one who learns the fundamentals of something, such as one who learns the alphabet. And because we were concerned with dealing with the really early building blocks of knowledge, we thought that this was an appropriately academic, airy term that wouldn't be in general use, and so a bunch of pedantic young professors thought that was nifty. This is a randomized controlled trial, and that's jargon for simply saying, if you want to know whether something works and you're dealing in the human sciences, you want to begin to test that idea with groups that are initially equivalent, and you want to expose those groups differentially to ingredients of a treatment, if you will, that you think are effective. And if you hold attrition low, you increase the likelihood of being able to make a strong causal inference when you observe group differences that those differences were due to the treatment that you intended to provide. It is a controlled trial in the sense that we had a specific treatment and we monitored the delivery of that treatment to see if we were veridical to our intent. I can tell you that over 95% of eligible families agreed to participate, and at the age 21 follow-up, 99% of living children continued to participate. So we have virtually no attrition problem, and we have no serious problem in generalization of these findings to other equally poor families. But we were after finding the most disadvantaged families we could within the county in which this project was based. The program combined early childhood education, health care, and family support, and it did so in a way that individualized those services within a matrix of services that families could receive. It individualized those services to families based upon their needs and their changing needs through time. So it was not a one-size-fits-all, but it was a tailoring within the limits of what was available within the treatment package. The primary goal during the preschool phase was to enhance school readiness and thus to establish a better base for transition into elementary school. These are some of the characteristics of the families who participated. This is arguably the most disadvantaged group of children and families ever reported in the early intervention literature. The families were desperately poor. The maternal IQ was on average in the mid-80s. 80% of the families were female-headed, a lot of teen mothers. And these two last items are psychological measurements of families' or individuals' attitudes toward life. These families were extremely authoritarian in their child-rearing attitude, which is characteristic of low-income families in general. They tend to have much more of a do this because I told you so or don't do that, rather than a reasoning strategy to deal with the development of their children. And the families, mothers in particular, felt extremely externally controlled, felt very little control over the course of their own lives. And that's probably a very reality-based perception. We took a very conservative stance toward testing the proposition that early childhood education was a key ingredient for school readiness, in that our control group received more services than most early intervention groups now receive in this country in 1999. Our control group received nutritional supplements, family support social services, and free or low-cost medical care according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. We wanted to rule out health, social services, and nutrition as likely explanations for group differences on outcomes if we saw them, and so both groups received that. So in kind of an algebraic way, they kind of cancel each other out. We provided a preschool treatment that began at 6 weeks of age because we wanted to begin early. It was 6 weeks because those of you with medical backgrounds will know that there's a very rapid development of the immunological system in the first 6 weeks. Group care for children in the first 6 weeks is likely to lead to increased illness rates. You want to wait until after that. Children were enrolled at 6 weeks. They came into a program which we provided daily transportation. It operated from 7:30 in the morning to 5:30 in the afternoon. It operated 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year. Children attended until they went to public school kindergarten. They attended well or ill. That's possible to do and not increase the likelihood of illness for exposed children if you take reasonable precautions, something that is not well known, but we've published that in a variety of places. It's very important in this era of welfare reform when you're trying to get mothers into the workforce and then you have care provisions for their children, but as soon as the child has a cold or something, the care providers say, don't bring the child here, it'll get the other children sick. It simply isn't true if you take reasonable precautions. The program had a curriculum, which I will only allude to in the interest of time. It's called Partners for Learning, and it emphasizes the interaction between caregivers and teachers, or caregivers and parents. And these are some of the characteristics of it. It was individualized to every child every day. It was a curriculum composed of hundreds of items that we had individually tested in prior experiments to determine their effectiveness and then put them into a package with a set of algorithms that allowed teachers to ascertain children's developmental status and to choose in a principled way a variety of activities to make the day interesting and enjoyable for them and that which would undergird their continued intellectual, social, emotional, and physical development. This is a summary slide of a lot of work. Red always indicates the performance of the treated group. Yellow always indicates the performance of the control group in these slides. We simply have taken mental test performance beginning at assessments at 3 months of age, going to 4.5 years of age, and we have put the treatment and control group together and we have standardized those scores and converted them to Z-scores. These are tests that all have a national normative mean of 100 and a standard deviation of 15, kind of like graduate record exams and LSATs and lots of other things where 100 is national average, and if you get a score of 85, it means you're at the 15th percentile. You get a score of 115, it means that you're up about the 85th percentile or so. What I've plotted here are the Z-scores of these two groups across time, and above or below each point, I have put the mean in the metric that the test was based in, the 100 with a standard deviation of 15. It's a little complicated, but it allows me to sum across different kinds of tests that are appropriate at different age levels. The point I want to draw your attention to is that over the first 9 months, these two groups don't differ. But beginning at 12 months and then their big time by 18 months, these groups do differ. And the difference is such that the a mean of 108 and the control group has a mean of 90, an 18-point IQ difference that shows up in the middle of the second year of life and that persists over the rest of the preschool years. If you think about social policy from an educational point of view, one of the things that frequently is invoked to talk about the magnitude of an effect of a program is something called an effect size. How big an effect did you have? And there's a way to standardize that, and it's a very simple formula. You take the mean of the treated group, the average, and you subtract from that the average of the control group, and you divide that difference by the amount of dispersion you have around the mean in the control condition. For those of you who are familiar with statistics, it's kind of like a t-test. Differences of bigger than about 0.25 are generally regarded as differences of sufficient magnitude to change educational policy. By 18 months, it's 1.45 and stays about one, somewhere between 0.8 and 1.2 over those preschool years. So very substantial differences. These are differences of the size generally thought to characterize, on average, the differences between blacks and whites in this country. What Herrnstein and Murray attribute to genetic differences, they're there because these were all African-American children. Those are the 15 points they're talking about. From a clinical point of view, if you have an IQ score below 85, 84, you're in trouble. Look what happens. These are treated children. Look at the proportion of children who show that decline. By 3 years of age, half of the children in the control group have IQs below 85. The children who benefited the most came from the most disadvantaged environments, particularly ones in which the mothers themselves had low cognitive performance, even though the mothers were perfectly healthy. It was an intergenerational transmission that was not genetic. And here's an example of the magnitude of that effect. Over time, from 6 months to 4.5 years, treated children remaining in the normal range, controlled children declining to, at 36 months of age, they're down at the borderline mentally retarded range, even though they're receiving these other services. On average, the children who attended the program and whose mothers had low IQs, by 4 years of age, have IQs that are 31 points higher than their own mothers. They benefit the most, and they benefit dramatically. The program has had an impact on the likelihood of the way that the mothers and children interact with one another. Treated children interact more frequently with their mothers, as this simple graph shows, and children whose mothers have low IQ and are in a treated group have a greater benefit than do children who are equally poor but whose mothers have average IQs, and we know why. The program has made the children socially more adept and responsive, and they become skilled partners in guiding their mother into more sophisticated interactions. That skilled social responsiveness extends into public school as well later. It's one of the ways in which this program has had its impact. The treatment also results in children who have had it going into public school and feeling that they are more in control of the grades and other feedback that they get, rather than feeling that that's due to luck or chance. And very importantly, in a variety of ways in which we've measured it, the preschool program has not had a negative impact on the mother-child attachment process. Interestingly, teen mothers derive a particular benefit in this program. By the time their children were ready to go to school, 46% of them had completed high school and were getting some post-high school education, compared to only 13% of mothers in the control group, indicating that there was a desire to continue that had been thwarted by the birth of their first child. And in general, we've published about 300 articles from the study so far. Here's a simple summary of some of the effects that we have observed. The interesting point I would make to you from my perspective is that to date, we have yet to find in this study or any other high quality early childhood education study, we have yet to find the first negative side effect. Usually in a powerful treatment, there's some negative side effect. We have not yet found it in any of our studies, nor has anyone else in the country so far. And the effects are quite broad. We wondered whether it was peculiar to North Carolina, these results. So we replicated the study, first of all, in North Carolina again, and got the same results. We then replicated it in 8 different sites around the country and called it the Infant Health and Development Program. And here are what we wanted to find out, were the results, particularly these big discrepancies over the first 3 years, were those reliable and replicable? So we did, these are Stanford-Binet IQ scores at 36 months of age from Arkansas, Einstein, Harvard, University of Miami, Pennsylvania, Texas, University of Washington, and Yale, on average of 13.2 IQ difference, showing 8 replications of what we had seen before with the children who were closest, most comparable to those in the Abecedarian Project, And again, there are a multitude of processes that have been positively impacted. All the ones listed here with a star have been positively impacted, and the effect is always to favor the children who received the early childhood education. Children who come from the most disadvantaged families, there are 1,000 children in this study, come from the most disadvantaged families marked by education are the ones who benefited the most. You will see that these are the numbers on which each of these bars is based, 232, 162, 165, 104. We have marked off this sample of 1,000 children into those whose mothers have some high school or high school graduates, have some college or college graduates, and you can see that the playing field is leveled in the group that received the early childhood education, and those who were most disadvantaged have had the greatest impact compared to their randomly assigned control group peers. The effect fades out at the level of college graduate children, children of college graduate parents. We were not able to boost performance there. And from a practical point of view, the early childhood education, going back now to the Abecedarium Project for a moment, some of the follow-up studies. At age 15, retention in grade as a function of early childhood education has been reduced from 56% to 30%. Special education has been reduced from 48% to 12%. Obvious cost implications of this for educational systems. By age 15, teen mothers in the control group have only a 30% chance of completing high school and getting some post-high school education, 80% chance in the preschool early childhood education group. Age 21 follow-up. Still differences favoring the treated group in terms of reading performance, differences that are on average about 2 years ahead in reading skills. Same is true in math. Percent attending a four-year college, arguably one of the more life-transforming events in this country. A threefold increase in the likelihood of going to college if you were in the early childhood education group. If you were a girl, you're likely to delay having your first child until after high school, compared to having your first child while you're still in high school. Again, obviously a life-altering thing, and something driven largely by understanding how biology works. And, whoops, let me just, I got two last slides. In very brief terms, I'm going to suggest to you that we did another randomization and tried to test the proposition of whether we could have altered the performance of the children if we had waited until kindergarten to begin. And what we know is that if we did that with a high intensity program, working with teachers and parents and running a great summer program, we have a marginal impact, an effect size of about 0.2 after working at kindergarten, first and second grade. So a marginally important impact on reading and math, and the impact goes away over the next few years. The program of making the children more supported during the transition to school serves to protect some of the gains that were made before. So from a public policy point of view, the early childhood program is clearly the most powerful, way more so than what you get beginning at kindergarten. And finally, this at the top says why early childhood education is important for communities and states. If you look across all the literature and sum it up as we did in a 1998 article, the evidence suggests that early childhood education, when coupled with after school and summer programs and good health care, increases children's development and readiness for school, particularly for at-risk children. When that occurs, we see an increase in academic achievement and social competence when children go to good schools. When children go to poor schools, those benefits wash out. But when they go to good schools, we see that there are decreased costs associated with absenteeism, grade retention, special ed, school dropout, juvenile and adult crime, youth services and incarceration, and teen and unwed pregnancy. This flow diagram is in the materials that Karen produced for you, so I will not go into that in any detail. My conclusion is that the evidence from 23 randomized controlled trials, and I count the 8-site infant health and development program as only one, are consistent in demonstrating that high quality early childhood education is a very important reducer of risk for children from poverty. We've studied it, it's been replicated. I think the issue is now one of political will. I believe that it is something that is within our reach to do for poor children, and I think the question to us is it important enough for us as a society to do this and to ensure that they have lives that are reasonably assured of productivity and equality.